Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Johnny Solomon, and we are going to be talking about what is unfortunately a very harrowing topic, a very relevant topic. We're going to talk a little bit about Pidyon Shvuyim and the recurring and really modern day question as well of redeeming captives in the modern state of Israel when they are unfortunately taken as hostage from the Jewish state. And we're going to really use this not just to talk about something that is very relevant at the time of this recording during the current war in 2023, but we're also going to use it as a case study for discussing broader methodology of Shalos and Tshuvos. So this is a podcast about Shalos and Tshuvos. We never really talk so much about the meta methodology behind it. We talk about it in passing, but something unique that Rabbi Solomon has done is that Rabbi Solomon has actually taken a step back and looked at surveys and samples of Shalos and Tshuvos, and he's going to share with us some of his very broad inferences that he has made in this genre of Torah study. Now, Rav Johnny Solomon is a Torah teacher, halachic guide, and spiritual coach. He teaches for Matan, Herzog Global, Melton, and LSJS, and he works as the virtual rabbi, offering online spiritual coaching, halachic consultations, and Torah study sessions to men, women, and couples. Beyond this, Rav Johnny writes a popular daily insight on Daf Yomi. He is a contributor to the RZ Weekly podcast. He volunteers at Sohar to perform weddings for secular Israelis, and he is a posek for his local shul in Evan Shmuel. I admire seeing all the amazing Torah things that you do online. I think I always like to say on every podcast, this is the first such and such that we're doing. It's not the first Tshuva of Aseh Lecha Rav that we're about to look at. Ironically, we're having two back-to-back episodes of Aseh Lecha Rav, though you can definitely remind our audience about him a little bit. But I think this is the first British representative that we are having on our podcast. And you know, there's generally what people say is that people with British accents sound smart, but what I can say about Rabbi Solomon is that he actually is very smart. And I very much enjoy following all the Torah content that you share on Facebook and other platforms. And it's a very wide range from halacha to medrash and beyond. And I think our listeners are in for a real treat today with Rabbi Johnny Solomon. So without any further ado, if you can just share with us, what are we looking at in terms of this tshuva from Aseh Lecha Rav? And unfortunately, in recent years especially, there's been a lot of literature written on the sugya of redeeming captives. So why did you pick this tshuva in particular?
Firstly, Shalom Aleichem, thank you so much, Rabbi Kurtz, and thank you for this opportunity. I've been learning and teaching Shalos and Tshuvos for quite so many years, and it's a real wonderful thing to meet somebody who shares this passion of this really important shelf of Jewish legal writings, which is often overlooked, often a closed book to so many, and yet fundamental understanding halachic application and halachic creativity. My interest in Shalos and Tshuvos began in many ways as a late teenager. My rav was a posek, Dan Gershon Lopion, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And when I was in yeshiva, I started learning Shalos and Tshuvos. Actually, I write about it while waiting on the phone, which is something which is not so needed nowadays with cell phones. I started learning Yechavedat, etc. And I was taken very much by the genre. And from then on, basically, I've been learning and teaching. And the reason why I mention that is I stumbled upon the Tshuvos of Rav Chaim David Levi. I come from the UK, and I assure you, I'm not aware, maybe now, but certainly when I grew up, of even a full set of Aseh Lecha Rav in any Bet Midrash or any library. I remember I was in one library with just a handful of copies of these green books in the category of Shailot Tshuvot. And I thought, what are these? And I started reading some of the Tshuvot, and I didn't stop reading. They were just remarkable because they blended this warmth, this creativity, this boldness and this sensitivity, an understanding of what it means to be a modern Jew, an understanding of the religious meaning of the state of Israel. And these were the first set of Tshuvot that truly spoke to me, somebody who believes in the religious meaning of the state of Israel, somebody who is halachically committed, happened to be Sephardic from birth, so he was a Sephardic chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. I have a certain interest in both Nigla and Nista, both classical rabbinic rulings as well as mystical teachings, and I found that in his writing. So already from the word go, Asera Harav was just like, wow, I've now met somebody who is my teacher, notwithstanding the fact that by this point in time, he was born in 1924, died in 1998. And this was just a couple of years before he died. And by the time I really discovered him, he'd passed away.
Oh, wow.
So I appreciate you giving us this background. And I think what's important about him is that he held very important rabbinic positions in Eretz Yisrael. So, you know, this isn't just someone who's, you know, in a base medrash in America or the UK, who's going to kind of from his armchair write a theoretical treatise on the halachos regarding Eretz Yisrael. But he's really in the trenches and he's receiving like real shilas. It's not like a true mesedeshen. He's not just making up his own shilas and answering it for the fun of it, but he's being faced with pidyon shvuyim concerns. He's being faced with this question of what to do with redeeming captives. And what's very interesting, I'm sure you could point out in the tshuva, is that of course he has a fealty to halacha, but he also seems to have an interest based on his position in the rabbinate in Israel to look after the interests of the state of Israel as well. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how that's fleshed out in the tshuva.
Well, firstly, just before I get to that, I'm so pleased you mentioned the Truma Sedeshen. But if you survey responsa, and you mentioned before that I've been doing this for a while, you'll know that most classic sets of Shas HaTshuvas have questions penned by rabbis to the Posek. Meaning most people, most, shall we say, Bale Batim, aren't writing Shilas to the great Poskim that feature in the Shilas of Chubas. They ask questions, they're Rav, and they're Rav, then write a question. What made Rav Chaim David Levi so unique is the majority of the questions in Aselech HaRav, and by the way, there are three more volumes of Mayim Chaim, that what made him unique is the great majority of the questions are not from Rabbonim. They're from lay people. And those lay people didn't just ask him questions, they challenged him. They said, you said this here, but didn't you say this elsewhere? And sometimes the pushback that he gets from the correspondence lead him to reconsider and reconfigure his positions. In fact, in the Sefer, the Avnei Lifnis of Birkat Shechiano, there's a great example of that. But as a chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, as you say, he had a view on and he had a deep interest in and responsibility for rulings in the modern state of Israel. And this, by the way, was fostered by his Rebbe, by his teacher, Rav Ben Zion Uziel. And in fact, he wrote an essay about the love of Israel and a factor in the decision-making of Rav Uziel, which was, by the way, translated in tradition. And it features originally in the back of one of the Aselech HaRav volumes. And you see that in him, that he has a love of interest both in the people of Israel and the land of Israel. And this comes through in many of his tshuvot. But in terms of this specific tshuva, which is found in Chelek Zayin, Volume 7, Simon Nun Gimel, Simon 53, we have a halacha l'maisa question, which had arisen a couple of years before, a few years before he wrote this tshuva. In 1982, in fact, specifically June 11th, 1982, three Israeli soldiers, Staff Sergeant Zacharia Baumel, Staff Sergeant Zvi Feldman, and Staff Sergeant Yehuda Katz, went missing in the Battle of Sultan Yaqub in Lebanon, where the tank fell into Syrian hands. And over time, the Israeli government hoped to secure their release, and they started floating the idea of freeing Arab prisoners, in fact, of freeing specifically 1,150 Arab prisoners who were being held in Israeli jails in order to get these three soldiers back. And this idea started to gain momentum a few years after this event, around about 1985. Now, in response to this proposition, Rav Shlomo Goren, who had been the army chief rabbi and then Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, who just retired in 1983, he wrote an essay in HaTzofeh based on the Mishnah Masechet Gittin, and he said, on no account can we allow this deal to be made, because we are taught in the Mishnah, En podenet shvuyim yetel k'ded mehem ipnei tikkun ha'olam. We have a rule, we have a klal, in which sometimes a price is too much, and sometimes we mustn't play into the hands of the terrorists by paying too much in terms of money or paying too much in terms of prisoners. And so this was the background of Rav Halevi's essays, Tshuva, because he disagreed with Rav Goren. He disagreed with him on a number of points, but specifically on this point, he said, I don't agree with Rav Goren's reading of these sources, even though, admittedly, Rav Goren was giving the most obvious and, shall we say, face level reading of the Mishnah Masechet Gittin, Rav Halevi said, I think the sugya could be understood differently. I think the sugya must be understood differently.
Right. So just to understand Rav Gorin's position, my understanding is, like you said, he's giving what we would call the pshat level interpretation. It says there in the Gemara that you can't pay an exorbitant price. Mm-hmm. And that's just a monetary price. But here, the stakes are even higher because it's not just simply we're paying a huge monetary ransom for these hostages, but we're actually returning criminals back to those who are then going to come back and harm us again. So, you know, Sinwar, who's busy leading Hamas right now, he was returned in the most, well, not the most recent one, but in the Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange. So mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, Rav Hershel Schechter, he has an essay in Be'ikveh Hatzon, and he makes an argument that this entire discussion is during what we would call relative peacetime in the Gemara. And even then, we have restrictions. But right now, and he argues since 1948, really, it's just been one huge extended Shas Milchama. We are mm-hmm. in one long, elongated state of war. There's more violent times. There's less violent times. So how is it that during a time of war, we can give money and even give prisoners back to them, which will then turn around and then they'll kidnap more people and murder more people, Rahman al-Itzlan. So I'm trying to understand. I think Rav Shlomo Goren's position seems to be shot in the Gemara, like you said, and shot certainly in a situation like Israel faces today. So what exactly is Rav David Halevi's response here? How does he defend such an argumentation?
Well, admittedly, Rav Gorin isn't the only person who's read those sources in that manner. In fact, if you survey all the tshuvot about releasing prisoners by different poskim over the last 50 years, 9.9 out of 10 reach basically the same conclusion, because the Mishnah seems to be pretty clear. And though it gives two reasons as to why we should have a sensitivity about Ein Podin, nevertheless, both lead to a conclusion that there is a price too high. But the whole question here isn't the reading of the Mishnah. Baruch Hashem, Rav Chaim David Halevi knew how to learn Mishnah, and so did Rav Gorin, and so did other people. The question isn't so much what is a Mishnah saying, but what is our reality? And whether the case being described in the Mishnah is a case that we face, in this case, in 1985, or perhaps nowadays in 2023, and in the years between. Because the point that Rav Chaim David Halevi basically makes is, arguably, the state argument, the responsibility for civilians and certainly soldiers' argument, and shall we call it the morale argument. In the case of the Mishnah, it was talking about individuals from Jewish communities who were taken captive for the sake of money, and those communities had a certain loyalty to those individuals, but they didn't have a sense of absolute responsibility. I mean, spiritual responsibility, yes, but no legal responsibility. If a person in your community is taken, you feel terrible and you want to do whatever you have to do to help them, but you're not liable and irresponsible of them being a citizen of your state or of your kingdom. Whereas according to Rav Chaim David Halevi, when you have a country, that government has responsibilities to its citizens. And especially when you have an army, that country has responsibility to its soldiers. And moreover, and this is the point which is really the true chidush and the tshuva, when you have an army, when your soldiers go to fight, and they feel that if they're caught, they won't be released, how they go to fight will be different. And so he makes the argument that morale plus responsibility of a government to its citizens and certainly its soldiers makes the reading of this Mishnah altogether different. This Mishnah talks about one situation, and the current situation post 1948, is altogether different when you have a government, when you have civilians, when you have soldiers, and when you have to concern yourself with this notion called morale.
Right. So I think that's a common theme you see among a lot of religious Zionist poskim, is that many times when it comes to these questions of the Medina, it comes to war, they many times will change the framework and say, many of these halachas we see govern civil law, they govern when the Jews are in the diaspora, when we don't have our own country, But when we have to rule our own country, many of the halachos really just don't have application to these kind of circumstances. And I want to read for you, this is on page 85 in the packet you gave me on the bottom. I want to just read for you the paragraph on the bottom and get your take on it. He says something which I think sounds very radical. He says, Zehaya kochem shel chachmei Yisrael ha-kadmonim, l'chadesh halachos al pi ha-yirum shizdam u'derechayim ha-lumim, that the power of the chachmei Yisrael, the wise men of early times, of the chachamim who led the Jewish people, they had the power to be mechadesh, to make up new halachos in order to help govern the national interests of the Jewish people. And not just to suffice with well-known documented halachos. And it's not just Chazal, it's not just the rabbis of the Talmud. Elagam gedoli harishonim. Even the medieval authorities and modern day authorities have the power to be mechadish, to innovate halacha. Now, what's he saying here? Is this as radical as it sounds to me? Is he just talking about a derabbanan? Is he talking about instituting communal customs? Or is there something more radical about the halachic system that he is asserting over here?
Well, overall, Rav Chaim Dovid Levi was a mechadesh. He was somebody who was prepared to write innovative rulings. He was the first to talk about how it should be forbidden to smoke, first to prohibit fur. He was somebody who was happy to say things first. He wasn't afraid of criticism from peers who may not necessarily held his view. Overall, though, what he's saying here is both, yes, radical, but also not as radical as you may think. Previously, he references a mice of Rabbi Yoshua, which Tosfos brings. He also quotes a Tshuva of the Radbaz, and he makes it clear that the Mishnah is a rule but which has exceptions in exceptional circumstances. And we need to understand, therefore, the situation, the circumstance. And that's the whole notion of being a posek. You have to appreciate what situation we're applying this law to. And if the situation is so distant from the norms of that law, then that gives us significant leeway to consider other factors. And that's exactly what he's doing. He's saying, I know the Mishnah. And if you are a traveler and this is what happens to you, then it's not much more than to apply the Mishnah. But when you're a soldier and, as I say, the government has responsibilities for you and you have responsibilities toward the country in terms of how you fight, this has a ripple effect on the considerations or the implications of how we apply Jewish law. And so he's teaching us a lesson about psika. You mentioned religious Zionists. That's somewhat true, but I want to mention just two sources which aren't this particular tshuva, but I collated in this booklet on overlooked considerations in Psak Halacha. Firstly, we've just been in the midst of war. I mentioned, or you mentioned beforehand, that I'm a posek of my community. And in the first Shabbat during wartime, and I live 20 kilometers soaring from Gaza, so really very near to the battlefield. My house shakes whenever we got bombs and explosions. We've got soldiers all around, etc., planes flying overhead. We were told to lock our doors that first Shabbat. It was very scary. But what do I do for my community when guiding them in terms of Hilchos Shabbos? Now, most people would think, well, we know Dinei Pikuach Nefesh, so all we're doing is applying Dinei Pikuach Nefesh. But there's a methodological error there, because you know Dinei Pikuach Nefesh for you as a Yachid. But in fact, most people do not know Dinei Pikuach Nefesh for a Rabbim, for a society. And Rav Emma Cohen has a whole volume of tshuvot about in Badei Haron on Pikuach Nefesh, which he introduces by saying, almost every source we have about Pikuach Nefesh talks about the individual. What we need to do is consider how Pikuach Nefesh applies when we're dealing with a wider situation, a societal situation, because rules change. And we find that precedents teach us that rules change, but we've often overlooked those precedents because they've not necessarily been relevant. So when I gave the Netunim the recommendations of my community about how to behave, and we've got guards doing guard duty, lots of things, you know, there are reasons to need to use phones and open gates and do all sorts of things and continue to do so. Those recommendations don't just emerge from a pikuach nefesh from a yachid perspective, but instead a broader thing. And I'll just say one further thing on this point. I'm a big fan of Dain Shlomo Tchovsky and his third volume of Lev Shomer Lishlomo, which was recently published. he has a biting critique on some parts of Jewish community and how they behave themselves during Corona. And the reason for doing so is, he says, you were applying attitudes towards Limud Torah of a Yachid in a time of a global pandemic. And that was foolish, because when there's a global pandemic, there are considerations way bigger than yourself, and to apply Jewish law as if you're just considering yourself is halachically erroneous.
Right, we call it public health policy.
Right, so it's a public halacha policy, and that's what I discuss in my booklet. Overlook considerations in Psak Halacha means we have to distinguish between a Yachid and a Tzibah. And so what Rav Chaim David Levi is telling us here is, Einachanama, yeah, I know the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is talking about a Yachid and the community's response to that Yachid. But here we're not talking about Yachidim, we're talking about Chayalim, which is part of a Tzava. Here we're talking about society. Here we're talking about people for whom we have responsibilities. And as a result, there are wider considerations, just as we have on Hilchos Shabbos, just as we have in other matters relating to healthcare, so too in terms of Pidyon Shvuim.
Right. And I think one of the sources that I recall gets cited in this discussion is the Minchas Chinuch, though it seems to push in the opposite direction. Minchas Chinuch asks, wait a minute, how could we ever engage in any war to expand the territories of Israel or et cetera? Isn't that pikuach nefesh? So he says, well, pikuach nefesh, the way you think of it, generally governs the individual.
Yeah.
It governs citizens. But by virtue of fighting in a war, unfortunately, the reality is people perish in combat. And so if the Torah commands us in certain instances to engage in melchemes mitzvah, to engage in combat, it's with the full understanding of knowing that there are risks taken into account and that inevitably, unfortunately, the case is people will fall. But there's a separate Shulchan Aruch almost for governing when it comes to the military there. And I would think that Minchas Chinuch is really a model for not just vis-a-vis the military, but vis-a-vis, like what you're saying, governing a society writ large.
100%. And that's why Rav Emma Cohen and Dan Dichovsky elsewhere talks about risk. In principle, I myself am not allowed to put myself in unnecessary risk as a civilian. So, for example, in the first few days after the horrific massacre, in those Yishuvim and Kibbutzim, just a half an hour from here, I said, I want to go there. And the fact was, there were still snipers in the area. And I said, I shouldn't. I don't have a justification. But of course, all the Chayalim who are here are going. So what's their hetan? I don't. The answer is, because they're Chayalim. And their risk-taking is permitted al smach for the sake of basically national interest, national protection. Meaning you can put yourself in the line of danger when you're a soldier, when as an individual, you may not. It is absolutely prohibited. And that's just one example of many.
Right. Well, one important thing I want to, I wouldn't call even pushing back, but just pushing for clarification is, I can understand that there needs to be perhaps a different framework for addressing the Jewish people as a national unit and taking national interests into account. But I think what becomes unclear to me is, how do we go about doing that? You know, like if we're going to say, okay, these halachos govern the individual, do we just throw up our hands, say, v'anachlo neidem anaseh? Okay, I guess it's open season. We can kind of just make up things as we go, especially when the decision-making, I imagine, you could tell me if I'm wrong, you're the one in Eretz Yisrael, but I imagine when the government is deciding whether to go ahead with a prisoner swap, I'm not sure if they have like the chief rabbi or if they have the posek hador with them who they're consulting to make sure that they are keeping in line with the halacha. So how is it that we see in Aseh Lecha Rav that he is defending the practices of the state of Israel? It seems almost like a post facto justification of a decision made by a government that is not necessarily going al pi halacha. So even if there is a national Shulchan Aruch that governs national needs, where are we pulling this out from? How do we know we're just not making up whatever comes to, you know, springs into our head? How do we know that's faithful to the Ratzon Hashem?
That question of how do we know what's faithful to Ratzon Hashem obviously is a broad conversation, which I think is going to take more than the few minutes that we necessarily have. But that's still an incredibly important one. Nevertheless, this comes back to a question of methodology. And I can refer to Rav Chaim David Levi and almost any responsible posek, and certainly including Dain Dichovsky, which is when you have military calculations, actually, you need to rely on military experts just as much as when you have health calculations, you need to turn to healthcare experts. You know, when I'm a POSEC and I'm asking questions which have any hashlachot in terms of health, I seek the advice of doctors. I'm not a doctor. I don't purport to be. And so really, it's a combination of their knowledge and understanding of risk and my knowledge of halacha and understanding of risk. And that comes together. So too, both in this case and others, we need to know that, yeah, you could make that argument. Or alternatively, you could say, actually, the government is exactly the ones who are in better place to make the decision. I'll just give you one random example, which I discovered 8 weeks ago at 2 o'clock in the morning when doing guard duty with a neighbor of mine who happens to be a prison guard, right? I'm doing guard duty. By the way, this is a grandson of Rav Moshe Tzuriel. If you know who Rav Moshe Tzuriel is, his grandson lives in my community. He's a prison guard not far from here. And we're doing guard duty. And as you do, you start talking whilst you're listening to the booms and explosions, right, in the night sky. And I say, so they were talking at that point about prison exchanges. This is before the first set of release of hostages. And he says, you need to know, at this point in time, I'm a prison guard of both criminals and of mechablim, right, of terrorists. We have at the moment, I think at that point he said, we have 6,000 terrorists. He says, we as a prison guard community, whatever you call that union, right, we are not safe. It's all very well and good talking about we should imprison all these terrorists. We have a ticking bomb in our prisons themselves. Don't think that that's so safe, because having so many prisoners in our prisons, right, which have various different stresses and strains, is not good for us as a society. And there's going to come a tipping point where it's going to be devastating. So he said, my professional opinion, and this was nothing to do with halacha. And I said, so what do you think? So my professional opinion is we should get rid of some of those prisoners. We should give them back. I said, well, how about the risk? He says, at the moment, we're at risk everywhere. You don't realize the risk we're carrying. And it just, the penny dropped by me listening to this individual and saying, you know, there are factors I have no idea about. The factors of the conditions in prisons, which are pretty darned important when understanding that in our cities, we have terrorists who are planning things together. And yes, of course, we run a risk of releasing terrorists. We also run a risk of keeping them too. And so when you have delicate questions in terms of healthcare, mental health, questions relating to security, one has to seek the advice of experts. And the experts themselves inform the halacha. Of course, the halacha can't be compromised in response to those experts. But nevertheless, it should be dovetailed with it. And just interestingly, I said that Rav Halevi wrote his tshuva in response to Rav Gorin. Well, if you look at that essay, Rav Gorin, which was subsequently republished in Torah to Medina, he changed his mind. He basically said, oh, wow. You know, I kind of agree with you. It was slightly reluctant, but he came to the realization that morale, and here I want to make this point clear, morale is an important factor in halakhic decision making. And just for you to know, in the volume of Badei Aaron of Rav Emma Cohen, when discussing questions relating to morale, he often quotes rulings of Rav Gorin, who changed his perspective, not just on this point, but on the role of morale in decision-making, such as, for example, if, God forbid, a soldier's been killed on a battlefield, can you remove that body if its presence is devastating to the morale of soldiers who are still fighting? Well, that's unfortunately, it's a real-life shaila. And part of the heter is, yes, for the reasons of morale. And
I presume this is rooted. I presume this isn't just a new idea, but this is rooted in Parsha Shoftim, the idea of someone who's going to basically evoke fear because he's afraid, and everyone else will be afraid, and we send him back because of it.
But that too is the reasoning of Rav Halevi in the first place, because as he writes in the Tshuva, if an IDF soldier knew that were they to be captured, the entire state of Israel would stand behind them for the sake of releasing them, then that soldier would be more likely to fearlessly risk his life during battle. But were it to be that we apply the rule of this Mishnah of not redeeming captives for more than they're worth, then it is reasonable to assume that every soldier would act with greater caution on the battlefield to prevent the possibility of them being captured. And then he basically says to Rav Gorin, so you tell me which is better.
Mm. So it seems like a pragmatic decision. This is what you're saying, which is it's all well and good that we have to, of course, take the halakhic framework into account. But the halakha would probably also want us to consider that, you know, when we talk about morale, it's not just simply people being happy. It actually affects their functionality, which then really could affect how they perform on the battlefield, which then has pikuach nefesh implications. Now, like you said, it takes a posek and it takes experts who really understand the psychology and how this works to make these determinations. But these are things that we have to take into account. Now, just in our final few minutes, I'm just wondering, is there anything else specific you want us to take away from the tshuva? And also, I'd love for you, you've already talked about your work on shalos and tshuvos. Are there any other methodological considerations or things that we should be thinking about from all of your expertise on this genre? I know you have a lot. I'll throw in one more thing. Because we have time constraints, I know you have so much to share. I welcome you also to throw in where our listeners can continue to hear from your insights.
Okay. I think it's important to understand what is Sikah, what is Psak. This is a distinction of Rabbi Lichtenstein nicely makes. But we often talk about sources. But a real psak isn't the regurgitation of sources. A real psak is understanding the application of sources to a certain situation. And what we see here is a classic example of saying, I know the sources, but you need to know that the sources don't know the situation. I know the situation. And in light of this situation, I believe there are other factors that need to be appended, other factors which are themselves sources, namely that question of responsibility, namely that question of morale. And yes, that may well be argued to be a chidush, but the notion that adding further considerations not mentioned in sources is somehow outside the framework of halacha is simply not the case. On the contrary, a posek must always be asking themselves a question, what other things are going on which the source I'm reading may not be cognizant of because the reality now is quite different, and this applies to every area of halachic decision-making. So I mentioned this as an example of a tshuva. I've mentioned a number of others by other poskim, but a posek needs to be a thinking person who understands a shetach, who understands what's going on in real life, which is why Rav Chaim Dalevi is so interesting, because he had this synergy and this regular contact with Amcha, with the regular people. He wasn't just sitting in the Bet Midrash. He was with the people. He understood what was going on in the field. He understood what soldiers were experiencing. He understood what morale is all about, because this was his kila. And as a result of that, he was able to make comment in light of that lived experience. That's the Varishon. Above and beyond that, I mean, there are people who have got very excited by this tshuva. David Ellenson has an essay about it. I think even David Hartman discusses it, because they get excited by the chidush hilchati, the innovation of the halacha, seemingly as tshuva. However, I see this as being somewhat of a red herring. Yes, yes, Rav Chaim Dalevi talked about chidush, and yes, it's an innovation to read above and beyond the literal meaning of a Mishnah. But fundamentally, this is what a posek does when they look at the circumstances. That's what most good poskim do in every good tshuva. And so if a person thinks that is a chidush, then actually it means that perhaps they haven't seen enough of this represented in the kind of shalos tshuvos that I've been blessed to study. I know you have been, and with your new sefer too. In terms of methodology, I mentioned that I've collated some tshuvot on this question of overlooked consideration in Psak Halacha, which includes a distinction between Yachid and Tzibur, or morale, and other things that a person needs to pay attention to. But I'd say one final thing. And I mentioned right at the beginning that I was lucky to grow up in a community with a remarkable posek, Dan Gershon Lopion, who was a Talmud Muvak of Moshe Feinstein, the grandson of Eli Lopion, had Shemesh with really some of the true greats. And it's only through Shemesh that you learn this. If you think you learn Halacha through Sfarim, then one would be surprised, and truth be told, perhaps even shocked by what Rav Chaim David Halevi is doing. If you've had real shemesh with a real posek, you know that psika involves the art of applying teachings with an understanding of reality. And that's why a posek needs to live with the people they help. They also need to be sensitive to the needs of those people. They need to make time to listen to the people they assist, which is what I try and do as a virtual rabbi. And in so doing, by appreciating those challenges, they're able to give them coherent, reasonable, thoughtful halachic guidance, which is true to the halachic tradition, but also resonant to the life being led by that person.
Absolutely. Very well articulated, Rabbi Solomon. And I think what you're saying, like what you're saying is that this, even though he uses the words of chiddush and innovation, what he's really doing is what poskim have always been doing, which is when there's a changing metzias, there's a changing scenario, a new scenario we have to address. But we're really just trying our best to apply the age-old principles that we have in our halachic tradition already. And yes, that is a form of chiddush, but that's not a departure from being faithful to the tenets of the Torah. And so I just want to conclude by saying, I know we discussed when we use Pidyon Shvuim and redeeming captives, of course, as a case study methodology. But of course, our prayer is, and our hearts are with the captives, with their families, and with your community and all that you and your loved ones are going through on the ground right now. My prayer is that this should all be rendered Lidrosh L'Kabal Schar very soon. This should be rendered Amen. Theoretical. And God willing, I hope even as soon as the time of the recording, I think there was a Rav Avadia Tshuva where they were discussing also a prisoner exchange. And he said, you know, by the time we finished deliberating it, we found out that the matter was solved. So my prayer is that it'll be the case as well for us. God willing, we should see Yeshua. We should see salvation for Klal Yisrael very soon.
Amen, v'amen. Thank you so much, Rabbi Katz.
Thank you, Rabbi Solomon. Take care.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.